In metropolitan New York, there are more cases of the coronavirus and more deaths from COVID-19 than any place else in the country. That's hardly surprising in the nation's largest city. After all, the history of cities is a history of overcoming disease among dense populations. But can New York and other cities as well survive this latest pandemic? Now, there's a book written a few years ago called The Triumph of the City: How Our Greatest Invention Makes Us Richer, Smarter, Greener, Healthier, and Happier. The author is Harvard professor Ed Glaser, a scholar of urban affairs, and he joins us now. Welcome aboard.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me on.
In the subtitle of your book, you call cities our greatest invention. But can they survive this latest plague called the novel coronavirus? After all, that's because it's so mysterious, it spreads so fast, often by people who don't even have any symptoms.
So the amazing thing is that over the past 40 years, despite innovations in communications and other forms of technology, cities have come roaring back, far from the death of distance spelling the end of the demand for proximity. We've seen a renaissance in urban America and great cities throughout the world, from Paris to Singapore. In some sense, the cause of this is that what globalization and new technologies have done is that they have increased the returns to innovation. They've increased the returns to being smart. And we are a social species that becomes smart by being around other smart people. That's what happens in San Francisco and Silicon Valley. That's what happens in London. That's what happens in Bangalore. On top of that, particularly in the wake of the declines of urban crime that happened in the 1990s, people rediscovered the fact that density can also be fun. It's fun to be in a place with lots of clubs and bars and art galleries, and it's fun to be able to connect with other human beings. And so, sort of amazingly, after the very difficult years of the 1970s, cities were able to come roaring back. But of course, that's all before COVID-19. And in a sense, there have always been these downsides of urban proximity. There have always been demons that come with density, high housing costs, traffic congestion, crime. But the most terrible of the demons of density is contagious disease. And for the past 2,400 years, since the plague of Athens slew Pericles in 430 BC, contagious disease has been killing urbanites, because just as it is easier to communicate an idea face to face, it is easier for a virus or a bacteria to hop from one human being to another when they're close to one another.
All right, so cities have been able to survive pandemics before, but don't they have to just radically change?
We have enjoyed a blessed century over the past 100 years after the end of the influenza epidemic of 1919-1920, in which our cities have become healthier, right? In 1900, a boy born in New York City could expect to live 7 years less than a boy born in rural America. Today, at least until COVID-19, the life expectancy gap went the other way. And New York, because of more people walking to work, because of more social connection, because of lower levels of motor vehicle deaths, because of lower levels of suicide, life expectancy was actually longer in New York than it was outside. Now, of course, COVID-19 reminds us of the dangers that come from face-to-face interaction. And history teaches us that this can go two ways, right? Urban areas managed to rebound wonderfully from the influenza epidemic of 1919. The 20s was one of the great city-building decades in American history, where we built things like Rockefeller Center and the Empire State Building. But the plague of Justinian that struck Constantinople in 542 AD led to basically 800 years of de-urbanization in Europe as the plague kept coming back and back and back. And so I think going forward, there are two paths ahead, one of which is this is a one-time shock. This is a disease, as terrible as it is. We find a vaccine, we invest in ways that make sure that we never have to go through this again, in which case human memories are short. There will be a temporary dislocation. There will be workers who have started working from home, and they will continue working from home. And I'll come back to that in a second. But I believe fundamentally cities will come back. If the disease comes back or new diseases continue to emerge, then in fact we will be looking at a radically different world, a world in which urban proximity creates more of a sense of fear than of fun, and we will have to rethink urban America, where you think they are urban world. That's probably less true in the developing world, which the sort of demand for the economic potential of cities is so great that even when there is a risk of urban plague, people will come to cities, as they did to 19th century American cities, when cholera struck down thousands, and yet people still kept on coming. Now, even in the best case scenario, we should expect to see short-term dislocations to demand for commercial real estate, to demand for urban space.
What is the view now of big business, the companies and the executives who, of course, have a whole lot at stake?
We recently took a poll of National Association of Business Economists, and we asked them how many of their workers who are now working from home, who hadn't been working from home, how many of them would stay working from home after COVID-19. And about a third of them said that more than half of them were likely to stay home. Now, I don't know if this necessarily will pan out, but there are good reasons to think that at least in some cases, people will discover that they can do their jobs from home, and that that will be efficient, and that that you know, there will be people who will transition to online commerce who hadn't done before, and that this will decrease the demand for commercial real estate. But I think that will be a 5-year, a 7-year blip. The strength of cities, if we can deal with the disease, the strength of cities is so strong that they will come back. And when you think about what America does as mechanization, as robots have eliminated the need for people to work in factories, for people to use their muscles, the one safe harbor for American workers has been the service industry, has been the fact that, you know, people will still pay for a latte served with a smile, for a piece of cake that comes with someone telling you you look great today. That human edge remains the most employable asset of Americans who don't have high levels of technological skill, and they're not going away. There are 32 million Americans who, at least before this pandemic, labored in retail, trade, leisure, and hospitality, and those people are going to need jobs, and for that reason, they're going to need cities.
Well, consider this. Facebook and Google and Apple have all invested in these big open plan workspaces, and now Facebook says its people can work from home till the end of this year. Do you think maybe that the open big workspaces need rethinking?
The creative value of those workspaces, the fact that, you know, they spent billions on creating this space, suggests to me that we are going to have the health investments we need so that human beings can be next to each other safely. It's not something that necessarily will happen overnight, but the fact that Google and Facebook think it's valuable to have their employees right on top of each other because that makes them more creative, makes them more innovative, is the best guarantee we have that America will have the health innovations it needs so that we can once again interact safely.
Well, cities in Europe and other parts of the world have been embracing pedestrian-friendly spaces, fewer cars, more bicycles, more walking. Is that likely to catch on now in big American cities?
It's a possibility, and there are certainly low-hanging fruit. For example, the on-street parking requirements are a ridiculous part of zoning codes. I mean, there are certainly easy things to change. But let's be clear. America is a country where people overwhelmingly drive. And the idea that we're suddenly going to become Danes as a result of this, as much as I find Copenhagen delightful in lots of ways, I don't think it's likely to happen anytime soon. So small adjustments on the margin, but unlikely to be a remaking of all of America's cities in a major way.
Okay, so in reaction to the current pandemic, a lot of structures are undergoing what the planners call repurposing. Stadiums and arenas are being turned into hospitals. There are pop-up hospitals in China, the Field Hospital and the Javits Center. Could one consequence of the crisis be a new emphasis on buildings that have multiple uses?
You know, smart architects were already doing aspects of this. Smart architects were always already figuring out how to have space that you could reuse for different things. In many cases, the constraint isn't the architecture or the engineering, but it's the zoning code. It's the fact that we have chosen to have in many of our cities legal regulations that micromanage exactly what you're allowed to do in a particular spot, which makes reutilization difficult, at least if it's an immobile piece of architecture. It is certainly one of my fondest wishes that we will, you know, strip away some of those regulations going forward, and that we'll be looking forward to a world in which we can be a little bit freer to use the space in the most productive way that it can be used.
Does that apply to the big commercial office buildings, the towers that are now sitting empty in Manhattan, for example? Even in LA has its towers of its own, and it's now being hit hard by the virus. What happens to that commercial real estate, will those buildings be seen as losing investments that could be sold off cheap?
It is certainly possible. It's more likely that they will cut the rent. So before we see long-term empty skyscrapers in a place like New York, you're more likely to see significant discounts. Maybe you won't be; they won't do it in an obvious way. But currently, you know, before COVID-19, demand for New York City real estate was sufficiently robust that you had lots of room to cut prices and potentially get someone in. In the sort of originally lower cost metropolises of the American Midwest, their vacancies remain a more real probability.
So on a personal note, I'm working at home, like a lot of people. Not only are we lucky just to be able to do that, I think it's very important to make that point, but we like it. We miss our colleagues, but we can talk on the phone, we can see each other on FaceTime or Zoom, and we don't have to commute in heavy traffic. We have more time. Will employers, do you think, start accommodating work-from-home schedules for employees? What did you find out in your survey?
Going to our survey, we found that about 32% of the respondents said that they think that their firm will be more geographically flexible after COVID-19 than it had been before, and only 20% said that they would not become more flexible. So about one and a half times more said that they would become more flexible. So there's some poll evidence that supports your contention that firms are going to have to be a bit more flexible going forward and a bit more willing to recognize employee taste. Now, again, if the threat of contagion continues going on, then for sure they're going to be much more flexible, just as they have been now.
All right. So the man who calls cities our greatest invention says they will survive, but it's not going to be easy. Again, the book is The Triumph of the City, How Our Greatest Invention Makes Us Richer, Smarter, Greener, Healthier, and Happier. Ed Glaser, professor at Harvard, is the author. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me on.
All right. Once again, it's not going to be easy for cities to be sustained. Let's hear more about that from a real New Yorker. She's Mary Bassett. She's former New York City Health Commissioner, now director of Harvard's FXB Center for Health, and a professor at the Chan School of Public Health. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You left New York City just in time.
Well, I think I'll always be a New Yorker. It's a great city.
It is. Well, tell us about the history of cities overcoming disease. Let's begin there.
Well, one point to make is that cities have long been seen as particularly vulnerable to communicable disease outbreaks. If you look at the vital statistics reports that are put out by the New York City Health Department, there'll be peaks of outbreaks of various diseases that we no longer think about, and in New York City that took many lives.
Which diseases?
Well, things like cholera, with yellow fever, these kinds of diseases used to occur in waves. Tuberculosis. So these were all diseases that were associated with cities, and cities, of course, are by definition dense and populous. But today, when we worry about cities, what we need to worry about is overcrowding, which is different than population density.
What's the difference?
For example, in New York City, the densest borough, which is New York City is comprised of five different boroughs, is Manhattan. And it's also the most affluent borough. And it did not have the highest number of COVID-19 cases. Those occurred in the outer boroughs of New York City, which are less densely populated. But in contrast to the density of Manhattan, the outer boroughs have much higher levels of household crowding, meaning that more people are living in single apartments.
What you're saying then is that the overcrowding is not necessarily the overall number of people per available space, but rather how many of them are living jammed in with one another.
That's correct.
So what then does that tell us, and what are the patterns in terms of the movement of the disease?
When I talk about cities and COVID, the point that I'm trying to make is not that the risk is that cities have a lot of people in them per se, which we all know, but that cities have tended to concentrate poverty. So even a very wealthy city like New York City, one of the wealthiest cities in the world, half the population lives at or near poverty. And that's what is posing the risks, because when people are poor, they can't afford to pay rents, so they end up squashed up together in overcrowded apartments. They may live far from their workplaces and have long commute times, which they accomplish by crowding onto public transport, which is also crowded. Many people squashed into buses or subway cars. So it's these conditions that made New York City ripe for COVID. Many people who are poor, many people who are living under crowded conditions, many people who worked in service jobs that were defined as essential and had to continue going to work because they couldn't afford not to work. Those were the conditions, not the, quote, city per se, that made New York City so vulnerable.
Speaking historically, how important has been the pattern of residential segregation over the years in concentrating people who are vulnerable in some neighborhoods but not others?
That's a really good point to make. And, of course, New York City, like many other cities in the United States, implemented programs. These were government-sponsored, effectively, of marking certain neighborhoods literally with a red ink on maps and making them ineligible for government-sponsored mortgages. That meant that people in these neighborhoods could not afford to buy their homes. And it really created a platform for disinvestment in these neighborhoods that were segregated by race. It was overwhelmingly African-American neighborhoods that were redlined. My parents, when they bought their house in Harlem, it was redlined. They couldn't find a mortgage. These neighborhoods became layers of disinvestment. The schools weren't places where people could expect to achieve. The public transport was absent. The concerns about safety were rife. All of these became characteristics of racially segregated neighborhoods. New York City is one of the most segregated cities in the United States. By some census measures, it's always in the top five, often in the top, ranked as number three or four, yeah. So New York City is highly segregated, and these same neighborhoods that I've been describing, where there are many people who are poor, there are many people who are Black or Latino. And so it was no surprise, I would say, to many people when the New York City Health Department released data showing that mortality rates were about twice as high for Blacks and Latinos as compared to whites from COVID-19.
So that goes to the causes of why we are where we are, but we're here. So what about the restaurants, the bars, the clubs, the theaters, the museums that are now going to be, I think, for a lot of the people who want to patronize them, no longer available or available in such a way that it's not very comfortable to be there and they're perhaps even fearful of going there? How do you overcome that and cause those people not to move out and leave the cities behind?
Well, you're right. There really are two parts of the COVID-19 response. One is the part that's aimed at saving lives, and the actions taken to save lives have been devastating to the economy. So a city like New York and the whole country has seen enormous job loss, has seen important sectors like the arts and tourism very hard hit. So you're asking why should people continue to live in a city if all of the things we treasure about cities, the diversity, the cultural richness,
not yeah? Why, but Will they?
Well, I would. I mean, I think let's not give up. Let's hope that we will get through this. We know we will get through it, and it really is only cities that have been able to support this kind of cultural vibrancy that we all treasure. But I don't think that we can minimize the economic threats to cities. That's the economic threat is sort of a unwanted side effect of confronting the health threat. I don't think that cities face a health threat per se by virtue of being cities because they are cities. Doesn't mean that they have to be COVID hotspots. We've seen hotspots in smaller in smaller residential settings. But I do think that cities are facing serious economic threats. I'm not an economist, but I'm worried about those. The New York City runs on Wall Street and real estate, really. And in particular, commercial real estate is facing real threats. I'm not sure how that's all going to work out. But for sure, no one should consider that cities are unsafe to live in because they are cities. The data show that people who live in cities are on average healthier. New York City has, for some years in a row, had higher life expectancy than the nation as a whole. And so I really want to try and debunk the idea that the reason that cities are vulnerable is because they have too many people. The reason they're vulnerable is because they've had too many poor people. And we are a very wealthy nation. We can make changes that reduce the risk that people face by being poor. We can increase access to health care. We can try and make housing more affordable. We can work on strengthening our educational system, our public education system. These are all things that can be done. They take political will to do them, but they'd be good for your health.
Take political will, and they also take time.
True.
But we're going to need to do them, do you think, in order to make cities safe? And
I don't see any way out. I mean, look, we have, what, approaching 40 million people who have lost their jobs or applied for unemployment insurance. And in the U.S., unlike any other wealthy country, most of us have our health insurance through our jobs. So many people are going to lose health insurance joining the 28 million people who don't have health insurance coverage, even with the much attacked Affordable Care Act. If that's still being fought in the courts. So it seems to me that now more than ever, it should be clear that people need to have access to health care, regardless of whether they're working or not. And it shouldn't be dependent on having a job.
What about, given all that we've talked about, the implications for mental health?
That's a really good question. I spoke to a colleague here in Boston who said that in some national survey that they recently undertook, that the number of people reporting depressive symptoms has doubled. Being isolated from other people is trying. And many people are, already struggle with mental health conditions, particularly common ones like depression and anxiety. And these have been conditions in which those increase. Those are risks that we have to consider when we consider the costs of social distancing. But there are more and more online resources available to people. These technologies, all of the video conferencing type technologies, are a way that people can connect socially, not just for work. But it's important to realize that there are mental health consequences of prolonged isolation. It's a very good question.
New York obviously is the biggest and densest population center in the United States. What about cities of the same nature in Asia and other parts of the world? How have they coped with the coronavirus pandemic?
That's a really good question because there are many other mega cities. There in Asia, there's Seoul in South Korea, there's Hong Kong, there's Wuhan, where this began, a city of 10, 11 million. Seoul is also about in that range, all of them actually a little bit bigger than New York City. And they were able to contain their outbreaks, something that New York City was not able to do. And they did it by using public health methods, by implementing widespread testing, which enables you to find out who's infected and who's not, and then using the techniques of quarantine and isolation of the sick, quarantine of people who've been exposed. And together with those, they were able to, you know, kind of rapidly bring down the number of cases and avoid the spread outside of their jurisdictions. So they were used public health methods. They work, but you have to let public health people know what they know how to do in order to see them succeed.
Once again, you were the public health commissioner in New York City from 2014 to 2018. Is the city, do you think, prepared to go forward in the way that you think is going to be necessary? Or is it going to, and could it be rendered similar to Seoul and South Korea and Hong Kong and Singapore anytime soon?
Well, I know that both the governor and the mayor are committed to implementing what's contact tracing and increasing the number of testing. Nothing can bring back the people who've lost their lives, and I think everyone would agree that loss of life was preventable. But if you implement these strategies, they will work, and that's what New York City is set about doing. Like all of the states in the United States now, they're taking steps to relax the social distancing measures in certain parts of the state. So we'll see how it goes. Being able to track the epidemic through testing will be critical to assessing whether or not the number of cases begins to go up.
How important do you think technology is going to be as we go forward and try to deal with all this?
Are you talking about things like cell phone technology or?
Yeah, well, and what we're doing right now and Zoom and all and working from home.
Right. Well, I think that we're witnessing a change that many of us are going to live with for quite some time. The only way out of highly communicable viral outbreaks is better treatment, which so far we don't have. But the most enduring way to get out of it is through immunity. I hope that will be achieved with a vaccine, which will also take some time. So for people who can work remotely, which is a huge privilege, I think many of us will continue to opt to work remotely. I thought you might be talking about things like, you know, using cell phones to track people, keep track of whether population movements, and some interesting things are being done with that. But I think that, you know, what we all have to recognize is that the way to tackle the COVID-19 epidemic is by winning people's trust, getting them to understand that they're asked to take these measures to protect themselves, their families, and their communities. And there's always a risk that technological surveillance can be used in a punitive fashion and not a supportive one. When that happens, I think we'll find that people are not very happy about it.
So there are a lot of trade-offs, and privacy might be one of them, and maybe people can get used to that, or maybe they can devise the technology in such a way that it's not really all that intrusive. We don't know if that's possible to happen. What do you say to people around the country and other cities, including Los Angeles? It's a massive area as well, but much more spread out than New York. And yet we see even here people saying that they're going to leave downtown Los Angeles, which has been increasing in terms of residential areas for a long period of time and finally becoming a real center of population. Do you think that's going to be a pattern that will be followed elsewhere in the country, that people will begin to move out and not concentrate in more densely than they already have?
Well, I hope not, because the idea that you can sort of get far enough away from this virus to be safe is one that would have many implications for our democracy. That's one thing. And also, it's clear that this virus, you know, is very adept at moving. It's affected virtually every country in the world. It's in every 50 states. With all of the efforts that were made, it reached the White House. So this idea that there's a place you can go where you won't be at risk seems to me a bit foolhardy. And add to that, you know, the challenges to our democracy if people who have the means decide that they want to be as far away as possible from the people who keep our society going and make sure that they have the resources they need for their daily lives. I think that would be the wrong thing to do.
You describe yourself as always a New Yorker at the outset of this program. You're now at Harvard. You were formerly the New York City Health Commissioner, but you spent 17 years at the University of Zimbabwe. What sort of perspective did that give you in dealing with these kinds of issues?
Ah, well, you know, I was privileged at the University of Zimbabwe to see a country with very few resources put in place a very robust primary healthcare system. And I learned there that when you engage with communities, you can achieve a great deal. And I think that's possibly been a missing element of some of my remarks today, is the idea that communities have to be part of the solution. Nobody can have enough people looking over them to tell them to wear a face mask or wash their hands, the individual measures that we can take to protect ourselves. People have to do that because they see it as useful and they believe the advice that they're told. And so, you know, we all have to work harder to win the trust of people in this country to follow public health advice. It's been difficult for people to believe what they're told when they're told so many conflicting things, including from the very highest levels of our government.
So obviously mixed messages has been a big problem. What do you say to what you saw over the weekend, what we all saw over the Memorial Day weekend, which was so many people on the beaches and crowded in other kinds of places, swimming pools and elsewhere, defying the rules of that have been defied, of course, by the president himself. But how serious an issue is that? And is it going to be possible, do you think, to get those people straightened out, if that's the right term, so that they understand, as you say, is so important, what is in fact good for them and good for their families?
You know, this is it's reckless behavior, and it's followed on reckless behavior from the highest levels of our government. You know, there will be more viral spread as people mix more. That's why we've been able to reduce the spread of this virus, is by reducing the amount of people mixing. And if people, you know, start doing these kinds of, you know, high contact interactions with groups of people, we're going to see more transmission of the virus, and that will mean more people get sick, and most people will recover, but some will get sick and die.
So it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Oh, I hate to end on a gloomy note, but...
Lift us up then. Give us reason for hope. Lay it on.
Right. Well, I mean, the reason for hope, I think, is that most people who get infected do recover from it. But the fact is that some 20% of people get very sick, and maybe 5% of them will need intensive care. And people who need intensive care face a very high risk of death. So, but that's the reason that we should all take care, because we can reduce our likelihood of acquiring infection and spreading it to others by paying attention to social distancing, the famous 6-foot rule, the hand washing, wearing face masks. We have some control over this. And some of how I react to people who are out there, acting as though this hasn't happened, is that people believe that they have no control over anything and they should just, you know, live their lives and see what happens. That's not a solution. We do have some control. That gives me hope.
Well, that's a much better place to end, and I want to thank you very much. Again, Dr. Mary Bassett is currently at Harvard, formerly a New York City Health Commissioner, spent a long time in Zimbabwe getting a perspective there. And I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me. Have a great day.
Now, let's not forget what we're talking about, a pandemic. A disease that is making people sick and killing them in every part of the world. It's historic. There's been nothing like it since 1918. But with all our modern scientific and technological expertise, history is something we're not very good at. After a brief break, we'll talk with a man who's done something about our lack of historical expertise on To The Point.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. Quote, "We exist in a moment when history is being made." Close quote. That's from a book that's worth talking about. With all our current emphasis on STEM in education, that's science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, history is something we don't know very much about. Certainly not enough to carry out America's global obligations or even, we might say, our ability to govern ourselves. That's the premise of the book. It's called The World, A Brief Introduction. The author is Richard Haass, veteran of government service at high levels, now president of the Council on Foreign Relations. Richard Haass, it's a privilege to have you on our program, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Warren. It's great to be with you.
Over Memorial Day, let me start asking you about the news. It was full of Americans defying stay-at-home orders, ignoring social distancing, not wearing masks. Scientists were wringing their hands. Joblessness is at 40 million, unemployment at 14%. But the week opened with the Dow up by 600 points, and President Trump tweeting, "The transition to greatness has started ahead of schedule." How does all that illustrate what you call the need for global literacy?
Well, it demonstrates the triumph of hope over experience. I would say that people are selectively grasping on to data points that support what they want to see, which is that the worst of the pandemic is behind us and that things are going to improve both in the public health sense and in the economic sense. Ultimately, they will. I don't think that's in question. What's in question is the time horizon. The reason that global literacy is so important is that this was a disease that came to the United States. It came from a small city, or not so small city, of 10 million or so people in China called in Wuhan, that virtually no one in this country had ever heard of. And to me, it highlights, as much as anything could, just how interconnected we are, that globalization is a reality. It is not a choice. What, though, is a choice is how we respond to it. But the basic lesson of this is that nothing stays local for long. Everything gets on the conveyor belt of globalization. And to deny it is futile. To ignore it is dangerous, like the ostrich burying his head in the sand, your wrist being washed away by the rising tide. and that we just have to have serious conversations in order, first of all, we need to understand it, and then we need to have serious conversations about how to prepare for it or respond to it. And that's where global literacy comes in, that we can't approach all this simply as the United States or as Americans. We're only 4% of the world's population. We're maybe a fifth of the world's economy. And a lot of these things, be they pandemics or climate change or terrorists, come to us, not from us. And again, so we do not understand the world. We are not literate about the world at our physical and financial and political peril.
Well, you've written a fascinating book, and I must say, and I want our listeners to know, that I found it extraordinarily interesting, even though I'm not involved in the STEM part of life, and majored in humanities when I was in college. But it's kind of a history 101, starting from the development of sovereign nations in Europe and moving through to the liberal world order. And you describe the liberal world order as something that's passing away. But first of all, what is it, and how did we get to it?
I'll answer that in about 30 seconds, Warren, if I may. Let me take a slight detour, because you mentioned STEM. And there is a real question of what we need to know and what young people ought to have under their belts when they leave high school or college or at any stage in life, if you want to be an informed citizen and make informed decisions about voting, about holding elected officials to account, about careers, about investments, about businesses. And in our curriculum, in many cases, we found room for STEM, for the science and the math and all that. And I'm, needless to say, not against that. But I think there are real debates, or there needs to be a real debate of what else we want every American to know, whether about our own political culture and tradition. The idea that so many Americans have never read the Constitution or the Federalist Papers or de Tocqueville strikes me as fundamentally not just wrong, but dangerous. Because we shouldn't assume the robustness of our democracy if people don't understand it. And again, imagine you're a young person now, your life is going to track the 21st century. And again, it seems to me not just wrong, but dangerous if you're coming of age in this century and you're simply you don't have the requisite understanding of this world that's going to affect your life for better and for worse. And I really do think we need an education debate about what a curriculum ought to consist of, whether it's a high school curriculum, a college curriculum, or just what all citizens need to know, even once they've moved beyond the age of being in a school or on a campus.
So you have written, as I said, a kind of history 101 up to the liberal world order. So having said that, that's the goal of the debate of education, is that we know more about it. What is it?
Well, the liberal world order is the world that's grown up essentially after World War II. It didn't, by the way, just grow up naturally. It wasn't spontaneous. It grew up because the United States, led by President Harry Truman and by a remarkable team of diplomats, essentially took the lead in creating and launching a number of institutions, the United Nations, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, plus built an alliance system, plus provided aid to countries that were endangered by the rise of Soviet-backed communism. And over the last 70, 75 years, these institutions, these alliances, these relationships have essentially brought about a world that's been relatively, I use the word relatively, peaceful. There's been no great power conflict. We won the Cold War. It stayed cold. It never became a hot war. And we won it on our own terms. The end of the Soviet Union, the end of the Soviet Empire, German unification, all within NATO. The world has been increasingly democratic, at least until 10, 15 years ago during this period. Lifespans have increased dramatically. Public health has improved dramatically, at least until this pandemic. So this is a world of essentially certain rules and restraint and values. And again, while not universal, it has been it stands out as a real positive exception to the rest of history.
Does it have to do with American dominance?
Dominance is a little bit too strong of a word, I would say, to American leadership, maybe American primacy, that we've been first among equals, or one might almost say first among unequals in terms of power. But it's had a lot to do with America
forging coalitions, again, whether they're formal alliances or other arrangements to deal with challenges. It's also had a lot to do, Warren, with the example we've set, the appeal of American democracy, the fact that while we've had all sorts of problems, say, racial injustice, in many cases we've made significant progress in dealing with them, the strength of our economy, the quality of our educational institutions, particularly our institutions of higher education that have become a real magnet for the most talented around the world. So I think it's a real tribute to the United States, and we haven't imposed this on the world. That's why I don't like the word dominant so much as we've promoted it by what we've done and by who we are, and others have wanted, for the most part, not always, but in many cases, others have wanted to join it.
But you say that order is not the natural state of the world, and the liberal world order is not just declining. You're now referring to it as the old world order, as the book goes on, and you say it's going to be impossible to resurrect it. What do you mean by that?
Well, this order that came up, the U.S.-led order, had a couple of bases, and one of them was the United States being willing and able to lead, and I think our will has been called into question towards the end of the Obama administration, but certainly under the Trump presidency, the United States has abdicated much of its traditional leadership role. We now also, secondly, have the emergence of other powers or centers of power, whether it's a China. Russia still has a nuclear inventory that's equal to our own. You have a North Korea that's developed all sorts of nuclear weapons and missiles. You've got an Iran. So you've got other centers of power. So the United States no longer has some of the advantages that it once had. And as I said, we no longer had the will. Plus, and we're seeing it with the pandemic, there's a whole new set of challenges that's come along for which there aren't international institutions or arrangements that are anywhere near up to the challenge. One is public health. Another is climate change. Another is the digital space, for which there's virtually no rules at all. So this combination of a reluctant United States, rising powers, old institutions that are now, in many cases, 75 years old, not up to the challenge, these new issues that have come along. So all of this has led to the deterioration of the world order that the United States and others built coming out of World War II.
Let me ask you a little bit more about America's role in the world order. You said it wasn't a role of dominance, but rather sort of demonstration. But there are those who say that, in fact, America has been exploitive of other countries, that it has multinational corporations headquartered here, have taken profits out of other countries to an extent that was unfair, and that at home there has been now illuminated by the coronavirus, terrible inequality with regard to health care. And of course, we know that that's true with regard to wealth as well. So do we have a lot to answer for and a lot to overcome here at home as well as abroad?
That's a big set of questions. So let me do my best. Start here at home. I guess I'd say two things. Yes, we have significant and rising inequality here at home. But I think that's the reflection of the problem, not the cause of the problem. And to me, the cause of the problem is that the American dream, the idea of individual advance for too many people, is no longer a reality. It is a dream. And there I put the fault at such things as the uneven and often poor quality of K-12 education in this country. Infrastructure's another problem. Certain prejudices are a problem. So to me, the answer, and the reason I don't focus on inequality as the cause of our difficulties, I don't think the answer is simply to redistribute wealth. I think the answer is to make opportunity real. And again, I would emphasize the availability of quality education as first among them, but also better infrastructure. I'd make sure that the laws that enforce equal opportunity are real. I do think we ought to have certain limits on inherited wealth. And so forth. Secondly, I'd say that even if we did different things in the world, less, more, did things differently, that would not necessarily or automatically improve the situation here at home. And I say that because so often people who argue that we need to pay more attention to our domestic problems, and I would argue we do. Where I disagree with them is that we therefore ought to pay less attention to the world. And I think the pandemic and climate change and other issues show the incorrectness of that line of thinking. I'd also just simply point out a statistic that what we spend on defense today, as significant as it is, as much as it is, as a percentage of our global economic output, is only roughly half what we averaged during the Cold War, which is another way of saying we can be active in the world and still do what we need to do at home. Our problems in healthcare, for example, are not problems of a lack of spending. We're equal to roughly double the percentage of our GDP that we spend on healthcare as the other wealthy countries in the world. But, you know, the last I checked, we don't live twice as long. So almost always in the public sphere, much more important than how much you spend is how you spend it. And that's a political problem more than a resource problem. So again, so for all those reasons, I'm all in favor of dealing with our domestic challenges. I once wrote a book called Foreign Policy Begins at Home on the argument that we did have real domestic challenges, and unless we fixed them, we wouldn't have the bandwidth or the resources we needed to have in order to continue to play a large role in the world. But the way to fix things here at home is not to allow things in the world to unravel. Let me just make one other point, because you raised it, this idea that our role in the world has been exploitative. For the most part, I don't buy that at all. Corporations, yes, they repatriate profits, but they also bring technologies to other countries. They create all sorts of jobs for other countries. And I've worked for four presidents, and I've never been in a room, and I've been in the Oval Office more times than most. I've never been there where people promoted, as a goal of American foreign policy, narrow commercial interests. And I'm not saying that hasn't happened in our history. It obviously happened in Latin America for a time. And at times, President Trump argues just that. But I've worked for Democrats and Republicans. I worked for Carter, Reagan, and both Presidents Bush. And I was never in a high-level meeting where people said the national interest ought to be defined as this or that narrow corporate interest. Our role in the world, for better and for worse, has been bigger than that.
Does it appear to you that with President Trump, there has in fact been a focus on narrow corporate interests, including his own?
Well, I'd say he's, more than any president in the modern era, beginning with Truman after World War II, he is focused on economic interests in a rather narrow sense, and has had a fixation about balances of trade, how much we're exporting as opposed to how much we're importing vis-a-vis individual countries. And at times, he does want to have a much bigger government role in trade, in the economy. I disagree with it, and it's a departure, and I think it's an unwelcome departure, but there you have it. So I think he is, in that sense, very different from all of his predecessors in the modern era. And whether he's reelected or not, I hope this is not a lasting feature of American foreign policy. Again, I think we need to have much bigger purposes in the role, whether it's maintaining order, whether it's promoting democracy and respect for the rule of law, whether it's alleviating humanitarian hardships, whether it's tackling global challenges. If we do all those things, that will create a context where American businesses will do just fine.
You said a moment ago that I'd asked you a big set of questions, and let me just say in passing, that's your fault. It's a consequence of the book and how comprehensive it is. The book, again, is called The World, A Big Introduction, and it raises a big set of questions, and it's irresistible to ask them when I have you on the phone. So what needs to be done? You talk a lot about things we don't hear a lot lately about arms control, non-proliferation agreements. Those things have sort of died out of the news of late, and for good reason, I suspect, given the coronavirus situation. But they're pretty important.
Yeah, what's happened is we're so focused on the pandemic, and it's all understandable. But it's not as though there's a giant pause button out there and that history is paused. So while we're focused on this pandemic, China is violating the terms by which it received Hong Kong. And you have North Korea continuing to advance its nuclear and missile capabilities. Iran is developing its nuclear capabilities. one out of every 100 in the people in the world is either internally displaced or refugee. Climate change is continuing apace, and so on and so on and so on. So we need to figure out a way to, while we focus on the pandemic and its consequences, we've also got to find the bandwidth for focusing on these other challenges, because they're not going away, and they're not getting better on their own. Almost nothing gets better on its own. It actually takes a degree of intervention. I don't mean armed intervention, but attention and intervention, and led by the United States with its partners. And it worries me that we're not focusing on all these other situations. So if and when the pandemic passes, whether it's in 6 months or a year, a year and a half, whenever, we're gonna open our eyes to all these other challenges, and we're gonna find out that not only do we have reduced resources to cope with them, but their demands, the problems they pose, have gotten much greater.
So, again, you say that order is not the natural state of the world. We have to work at it all the time. It's going to be impossible to resurrect the order that was constructed and called the liberal world order. Now you're suggesting that there are just a whole lot of things we have to cope with all at the same time in order to move forward successfully. How optimistic are you about our ability to do that?
Optimism's about performance. Am I wildly optimistic? No. But if I had a magic wand, I would say let's focus on a few things beyond the pandemic, the public health, and the economic recovery challenges. I would focus on righting our relationship, righting, relationship with China. This is the most important bilateral relationship in the world for the foreseeable future, for decades to come. So I would invest heavily in that relationship. I'd like to avoid, if possible, a quote-unquote new Cold War with China, which would be risky, but also a massive distraction for both countries. I would like to do more about climate change and some of these other global issues where there's an enormous gap between the scale of the challenge and the degree of global cooperation. And we still have to deal with the old foreign policy agenda, the North Koreas, the Irans, and what we were talking about before. We still got to deal with all of our domestic challenges. So it's ambitious, it's demanding. I'd also say, though, it's essential. If we don't deal with these things, we're going to pay a price. Again, coming back to where we began the conversation, the fundamental lesson of the pandemic ought to be that we can't insulate ourselves from bad things that happen in the world. That, by the way, was the lesson of 9/11. In that case, it was Afghanistan. In this case, it's China. In the case of climate change, it's the cumulative effect of what happens everywhere. So I'm hoping that people take this expensive experience and turn it into a valuable lesson. And the corollary to the lesson is that we need partners in dealing with these issues, that unilateralism, America only, is not a viable strategy for this country.
You said you had worked for four presidents. We have a presidential election coming up. There's nothing in the book that suggests your political views. But can I ask you what they are? What kind of president do we need?
Well, I run a nonpartisan, or I head a nonpartisan institution, the Council on Foreign Relations. So I'm scrupulously nonpartisan. It doesn't mean I don't have opinions. It doesn't mean I don't vote. As you mentioned, you know, I have worked for four presidents, though they're from both parties. What I would want is a president who would essentially echo what elements of what I just said: the importance of the world to the welfare of the United States, and the importance of the United States forging partnerships or making the most out of existing partnerships like our alliances in dealing with these challenges. And, you know, the bottom line, I would say, has to be that foreign policy is not foreign, and that the next president, if it's Mr. Trump, he would have to change his ways to come close to what I was describing. If it's Vice President Biden, I think it comes more naturally to him, given if the past is prologue. Either one, though, whoever wins in November, he's going to inherit a daunting inbox. It is arguably going to be the most difficult presidency imaginable, because it's going to take place against the backdrop of a country that's turning inward because of the pandemic, where trillions of dollars are being spent to deal with the immediate economic effects. We're getting, you know, and I don't know, as we have this conversation, Warren, what the state of public health will be at the time in this country or elsewhere, but it's quite possible that it will still be an extremely difficult public health environment unless there's a vaccine that comes along that can be manufactured and distributed on a large scale. But short of that, we know it's going to be a difficult economic environment, and it could well be a difficult physical environment.
Very quickly, before I let you go, how would you describe the purpose of the book in the context of what you've just said?
Look, what led me to write the book is straightforward. I was worried that we live at a time where the world is so fundamentally important to us all, and how so few of us really understood the world, that you could graduate from virtually any high school or college or university in this country and not know the basics, not have a foundation that would help you make informed choices as a citizen, that would help you make better choices for yourself or your family in terms of careers or business or investments. So I went out, you could say immodestly, to write a relatively short, accessible single volume. There's only about 300 pages of text. So a kind of one-stop shopping primer for people so they could get a foundation to make sense of the news and help reach a point where they could simply make better decisions as they go about their lives. So it's essentially a primer to give you the foundation, to give you the lens you need to make better sense of this world and the news that's coming at us.
Well, let me just say, as I did before, that I think it succeeds in the goal you just laid out. It certainly does provide a primer. It is accessible to a lay public, people like me, and others as well, I'm sure. And it does raise, at the same time, by doing what it does, a big set of questions, and that's one of the interesting things about it. I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Again, the book is called The World, A Brief Introduction. It's by Richard Haass. He's a veteran of four presidential administrations and now president of the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Warren.
The producer of To the Point is Andrea Brody. Our engineer is Chuck Prevetere. Other episodes are available on your favorite podcasting app. If you want to reach us, we're at tothepoint_KCRW. If you want to reach me directly, I'm at WarrenAlney1. Social distancing won't get in our way. We'll be back as usual so you can stay alert as well as informed. Thanks for being with us this time, and join us again.